You know, it didn't even feel like bravery at the beginning because I didn't even realize that there was any other way. To me, doing the work the way that I did it, right? Trying to really find out what employees wanted and to design initiatives that work, there's nothing brave about that to me. That just feels correct.
Today, I will host Lily Zhang. Lily is a non-nonsense diversity, equity, and inclusion speaker, strategic, and a consultant who helps organizations and leaders achieve the DEI outcomes they aspire to. Lily's work has been featured in the Harvard Business Review, New York Times, and NPR. They are the author of the book DEI Deconstructed. Today, we will speak about how to help leaders to progress on diversity, equity, and inclusion outcomes, what the challenges are, and how to overcome them to lead a thriving organization. So stay with us. Lily, thank you for being with us.
Yeah, I'm thrilled to be here today.
I would be happy to hear your insights about the highest or lowest point of your life or in career path. And what have you learned from this path?
Yeah, that's such a great question to start with. So I'll talk about the lowest point of my career path. And that was probably when, let me think, 1 or 2 years into starting my business as a consultant, things were pretty difficult for me. It's quite hard to succeed as a diversity, equity, and inclusion consultant. It's a big field, and it's tough to get your name out there and get your foot in the door. And so at the time, I remember having very few clients. I wasn't getting that much work through the door. And I had just gotten really lucky, it turns out, because a big corporation based in the US had reached out to me and said, Lily, we want to work with you to help us design this new allyship training or talk for our employees. And I was so excited. I was like, oh, finally, my big break. Finally, you know, I'll be able to make rent because I was struggling to even pay rent at that time. It was pretty difficult. And I remember going into that company, doing my usual process, talking to a bunch of people, doing some interviews, some focus groups. And there was a really interesting thing that came out of it. The people I talked to said, we don't want this allyship event. We don't want to do it. So stop asking us how to do it. None of us want it. The leaders of this company are using this as an excuse to not actually do the important stuff that we've been telling them to do. So I went back to leadership and said, hey, really interesting. It turns out nobody wants this thing that you told me to design. So I highly recommend that you do something else. And this is what people want you to do. They want you to make some policy changes. They want you to have a public stance on these issues. And that's the feedback. And the leader said, Lily, we didn't hire you to do that. And they fired me on the spot.
Wow.
And so at this lowest point, when I really needed this position, I thought I was doing them a big favor by telling them what they actually needed to know. And they didn't like that. They essentially had the mindset of, well, we brought you in to do this one thing and you didn't do the one thing. So out you go. And I was in a really tough position because, you know, I was thinking after I lost that big opportunity, it would have paid really well. Like it would have paid me extremely well. And suddenly out of nowhere, I had lost it because I kind of stuck to my morals and did the work the way that I felt like it should be done and was punished for it. So I spent a couple months feeling really down because I wasn't making very much money. I wasn't getting very many client opportunities. And I had wondered, like, did I just blow my big chance to get into the field by sticking to my morals? And at the end of the day, several months later, I was reflecting on and thought, no, I think I did the right thing. It was the client that wasn't the right client for me. I should be pickier and pick clients that are willing to do the work. And so from that point, I tried to reframe it as, my approach is the right approach. I just need to keep trying and to find clients that are willing to respect me and pay me for the work that I'm going to do, rather than trying to compromise my own values to get a paycheck. So that was the lesson that I learned, but it was a very low point for me. It was several months of feeling really bad and wondering if I should change my career path because I just wasn't finding success.
Wow, such an amazing story. Thank you for sharing. You know, my body is shivering because I think there's a lot of companies that you experienced in the beginning of your career that taking like a corporate sustainability or promoting agendas that they don't really believe in them. Mm-hmm. So they speak and they don't walk the talk, and employees feel the gap, right?
Absolutely.
It's amazing because you were connected to yourself and what you really wanted to bring to the workplaces and to the corporate world, and you didn't want to sell yourself. So I think it was a brave, brave thing to do. You had to pay the price at this point, but I think it gave you such a big present for your career, because you fine-tune your way and your values and what's important for you. And you decided then that you don't want clients like them. So I think it's amazing, but you needed to be brave and pay the price that you paid.
You know, it didn't even feel like bravery at the beginning, because I didn't even realize that there was any other way. To me, doing the work the way that I did it, right? Trying to really find out what employees wanted and to design initiatives that work. There's nothing brave about that to me. That just feels correct. And it was what these corporate leaders were asking me to do, which is to ignore employees and to just design this check the box exercise that would make them feel good, but not solve any problems. They wanted me to do that. I had no idea, because if they had told me that, I would have said, why do that? It's not going to work. What's the point? So if anything, I was naive rather than brave. But I learned a lot from that experience for sure. And I feel like definitely today, if I were asked to do the same thing, like it would feel brave, because now I know that a lot of leaders, unfortunately, are intentionally trying to not walk the walk. Yeah, right. They're intentionally trying to avoid doing the hard work to just get by as easily as possible.
Yeah. To use it as a PR experience to show the right thing, but actually not. And another thing before we move on, because it really touches upon a conversation I had yesterday about bravery. It's funny because we talked with a session with a company that I'm working in, and I said, okay, what is bravery? And we said, actually, what you're saying, sometimes that someone look at us and say, why, what a brave person. When we act according to our values and what's right, we don't feel that we're brave. We're feeling exactly that we're doing the right thing, right? Mm-hmm. Others look at us and say, wow, what a bravery. I think it's a really interesting insight that when we are listening to ourselves and working from a mindful and connected place, it feels natural. And, you know, as you said, if the companies don't want to work with us or there's a risk there, it's okay, because we don't want to risk losing ourselves. And this is actually what you chose, yourself over money, over prestige, over working with the big clients.
And now I do still work with big clients, as it turns out. It's just the big clients that are aligned with the way that I do this work. And it's required that I be much pickier with the people who reach out to me. I get a lot of people who reach out these days. I think I turn down 80 to 90%. Of the requests that I get, not because I don't want to do the work, but because they're not in the right place to be working with me effectively. And I'm extremely lucky that I have enough security to say no so many times, because I think back to how I was when I was just starting. I didn't have the luxury to say no, because I was hardly able to put food on the table. Yeah. And so that's a big reflection on how, you know, when practitioners are just starting off and, you know, they're not making much money at all, it gets so much harder to live your values because of the squeeze of that job insecurity and that income insecurity. It's a problem that a lot of people face.
That's right. And always holding the balance between, right, the kind of the survival mode and the thriving mode and where the line moves. Okay, so thank you very much. I can continue with hours with this conversation, but let's move on to the professional questions. So you're frequently working with leaders to help them progress on diversity, equity, and inclusion outcomes. What does it look like in the practice if we're moving to the practicality of the day-to-day?
Yes, absolutely. So the big crux of my work is focusing on diversity, equity, and inclusion as outcomes rather than intentions. This is the centerpiece of my entire approach to DEI. And it's necessary because of the exact problem that we've just been talking a little bit about, because leaders can say, oh, diversity, equity, inclusion, diversity, equity, inclusion, or, you know, sustainability, for example, right? And not walk the talk. And so my focus is not on how much people care. It's not on how much effort people put in. And it's not even on how much effort people, or it's not even about the activities that they do. Everything that I focus on centers on the outcomes companies and leaders are able to achieve. And so sometimes it sounds a little blunt when leaders say, oh, I care so much about diversity. My question is, then how much diversity do you have? When leaders say, I care about equity, I say, do you have pay equity? Does it exist? Is there equity in experiences? Does everyone feel like they have opportunities to advance? Is there equity there? Is it measurable? When people say, I care about a respectful workplace, I say, good. Do your employees feel respected? Because at the end of the day, it's not about what leaders care about. It's what they're able to achieve through their efforts. And so in response to your question, the practical work of achieving DEI as outcomes means cutting through the nice language and the PR speak and focusing on what programs or interventions will get a workplace that starts off from point A of being not very diverse, not very inclusive, not very equitable, to a point B where it's measurably better on all of those aspects. It's tough. And sometimes it can be very boring because the long-term effort of achieving pay equity, that's one example of a goal, is quite tough. You need to write new policies. You need to train new managers. You need to make sure that people who are making decisions in biased ways are taught to do otherwise. And if they're not willing to do otherwise, you need to, you know, discipline them or remove them from the organization. It's a long-term journey, oftentimes taking many months, if not many years, to get from that point A to point B. And I was talking earlier about how, you know, companies are scared to walk the walk because that journey takes a long time and everyone's looking for the really quick 1 week solution, right? Oh, Lily, people are upset. Can you fix it in 1 or 2 weeks? I'm like, no, absolutely not. Because leaders think that I'm like going into their house and fixing a broken window, but it's really changing the foundation of the entire house. And that requires a lot more effort. So when you ask what does the practical work look like to create outcomes, it's that long-term work to shift policies and processes and practices and leadership and culture and all of those big things, which often takes many months, if not many years.
It's actually a really transformative work, right? Because you're transforming the culture of the company. Mm-hmm. So it's a really deep work. Mm-hmm. Can you give it as an example of a client that you worked with and what the starting point and where did you reach? What were the outcomes that you achieved and what were the process? It's interesting to understand, you know, what's happening in the day to day.
Yeah, absolutely. So with the caveat that I'm one person and it's very difficult for one person, even a consultant, to fully change an entire organization. I usually work with clients that have a specific issue that they're trying to solve. With one client, I went into one of the major services that I offer is assessment. So essentially the logic goes, I can't fix their problems unless I know their problems. And most of my clients don't actually know their problems either. They might have one or two employees who say, hey, I'm having a tough time, but they don't know to what extent those problems are systemic and run all the way down, or to what extent it's just, you know, one or two people having a hard time. So I go into client orgs and I deliver that big assessment. I survey their workforce. I collect data on their promotion, retention, hiring rates, and I disaggregate that data by race, gender, sexuality, ability, and all of these demographic characteristics, anonymously, of course. Mm-hmm. And then I see what's going on. In one company, it turned out very clearly they were actually hiring a lot of women, of people of color, minorities, so on and so forth. And somehow the retention rate for all of these groups was very, very low. After about a year, they would all quit. And so even though they spent a lot of effort to bring in, you know, all this diversity through the door, then it would just disappear after a year. So I went around and asked, like, hey, what's going on? Why are things so difficult? And why, after accepting the offer to come to this company, are folks like you leaving after a year? And the feedback was very consistent. I'm not feeling supported. I don't have a community. My manager is not equipped to make space for me. I don't feel like I'm getting the support I need. And I realized this company completely lacked a formal onboarding process. There was no onboarding. The way it worked is when new employees would come in, informally, managers would just be friendly with them and try to offer them support. But because most of the managers were older white men, they were selectively only offering support to white men new employees. And it wasn't even on purpose. They just felt more comfortable offering support to white men employees. They wouldn't offer that support to women or Black people or Asian people because they simply didn't feel comfortable. And there was no formal process. So given all of that, I said, I think we need to develop a formal process and we need to have this created with the feedback of everyone, not just the white men, right? Everyone's feedback. So we ended up creating that process, creating that program to help employees in the first 6 months of their time within that org. And it took quite a while to create because we had to get everyone's feedback. We had to understand, you know, what aspects of the new employee experience do you need support around? Do you want regular meetings with people in your cohort? How often do you want to talk to managers? What do managers need to know to feel more comfortable offering that mentorship and support? And we figured it out eventually. And a year or two later, we surveyed that same cohort coming in and they were doing better. We didn't fully fix the problem because, like I mentioned, this work is long term, but the numbers were meaningfully better. We meaningfully reduced the turnover for women and people of color in these cohorts by, I think it was something like 20 or 30%, which was a big deal after just 1 year of that program happening. And as far as I know, that program still exists, right? So that's an example of the practical applications of this work. You figure out the problem, you understand who it's affecting, you design an intervention that hopefully solves it, and then you measure again to see how it's successful and where you need to continue tweaking it. And you just do that at scale for everything. And that's what diversity, equity, and inclusion work looks like.
It amazes me the bias that we have. Look, the company talked about these values, but at the end of the day, they didn't walk the talk. They didn't embrace these values. Like, they were biased how the people, they look like them. It amazes me how much impact it has on the day-to-day.
So that's a really interesting point, because you're right in that there were definitely managers involved who had biases regarding who they talked to. But the fundamental problem wasn't the managers. It was the fact that there was no formal process. Mm-hmm. Because just by implementing that onboarding process, we were able to solve so many problems. Now, there are other practitioners that focus on what we call the hearts and minds approach. So trying to change the hearts and minds of people to eliminate their biases. So some people might have had the same situation and said, you know what the problem is? The managers are biased. Let's offer unconscious bias training to fix the problem. And I take a slightly different approach. I actually think that while everyone's biased, including me, including you, we're all biased, We can make sure that our impact is unbiased if we design a good process and a good practice that helps us act fairly. Because at the end of the day, after this onboarding program was designed, I don't actually think that we fundamentally changed the way managers were thinking. I don't actually think we solved their biases. What we did was we implemented a structure and a process that made it so their individual bias couldn't actually affect the outcome. Mm-hmm. And in my opinion, it's easier to design and onboarding process than it is to fundamentally change how people think. That's really, really difficult. And we know from research that unconscious bias training is actually not very successful. It's not very effective. People become the way they are because they've had an entire lifetime to learn biases. So how are they supposed to unlearn that in 1 month of training, right? It's very difficult. But if we set shared expectations for how we're going to engage in onboarding or hiring or promotion, that can short circuit our biases. That can let us pass through those biases without needing to fundamentally change who we are as people. And so that's a hallmark of my approach, focusing on the structure and the system rather than just people's hearts and minds.
Okay, I love it. So you're talking, let's do something holistically, but it will start with the behavior and the processes in place. This will help us embed the culture that we want. Otherwise, we can talk and values, but at the end of the day, it will be on the wall, but we won't walk the talk. So it's really important to see how it implements in the day-to-day structure culture. This is a great point. Thank you. Tell me, what common pitfalls can well-meaning leaders stumble into when trying to lead inclusively on DEI initiative? We talked about right now one thing. Is the other thing that you can, comes to mind when I'm...
Yeah, common pitfalls. There's a lot of common pitfalls. So oftentimes, well-intentioned leaders will spend a lot of time trying to ask people from marginalized groups, whether women, people of color, disabled people, LGBTQ plus people, to do the teaching. So leaders who, you know, want to be inclusive will say, oh, I don't know about this topic. Can you teach me? Can you teach me? Can you teach me? And it's coming from a very good place. They don't want to say the wrong thing. They don't want to mess up. They want to learn. But the reason why that's a pitfall is over time, they have a leadership role. And so anyone they ask to teach them, especially if they're asking someone who reports to them, they can't say no, right? If your boss said, hey, teach me about women, are you going to say no? No, right? He's my boss. I should probably do what he wants. But imagine if every single day at work, you're just trying to get your work done. And your boss says, teach me about women, teach me about women, teach me about women. Eventually, you'll say, this isn't my job. I wasn't hired to do this. I'm busy trying to do marketing or sales or engineering or product or whatever. I'm not here to teach you about this big social issue. Yeah. And so this is the problem that a lot of well-meaning leaders face. They try to ask, which is a good thing, but they don't. They are not aware of how their power as the manager impacts the conversation. And so over time, this can make employees feel really stressed out and really unhappy because not every employee is a social educator, right? Lots of women are not equipped to teach about the history of sexism. Like lots of Black people aren't equipped to teach about the history of racism. Lots of trans people or gay people are not equipped to teach about LGBTQ plus issues. We're just trying to do our jobs. And so when managers ask all of these hard questions without doing homework, without even Googling it, sometimes you can just Google these questions and you can find answers, right? It puts a big burden on employees to do the educating. And that can sometimes, paradoxically, be its own form of discrimination almost, right? Because there are these high expectations that on top of your normal 9-to-5 job, you have to do all of this education work for free to your manager and you can't say no. And well, suddenly it starts to feel worse, right? It doesn't feel like a positive thing anymore.
Yes, it's interesting because you say it's a power relationships and they don't feel comfortable saying no, but I think I'm sure the intention is good, but if leaders will be aware of it and will invite people that want to cooperate with it as an invitation, you know, it will be different because people can choose. I want to do it. I don't want to do it. But it's the how you do it.
Can the how is so important. Yeah.
Right? This is what's important because the intention sounds actually good. Another question. Many people follow your thought leader on LinkedIn. How do you approach your work from a mindful leadership lens? And what lessons can our audience take away?
Yeah. So my own work as a leader. So I always try to be very aware of my own perspective and the fact that my experiences are not experiences that everybody has. And so I don't want to fall into the trap that, by the way, a lot of other very well-intentioned leaders fall into, which is thinking that my life experience is the only life experience. Sometimes leaders might have their own journey and they might reflect on their own journey and think, oh, I have these big takeaways from my own life and I'm going to apply them to everybody. Because of course, everyone has the same experience as me. It's a sort of self-centeredness and ego sometimes that can get in the way of them practicing empathy and trying to understand multiple different perspectives. So for me, when I try to lead mindfully, I of course share my thoughts. I'm very lucky and grateful to have a platform on LinkedIn and a lot of followers who apparently want to hear what I have to say, who, you know, really hang on to the words that I share on LinkedIn. But I try to be very aware that I'm only sharing one perspective from my own experiences and from what I know. And when other people disagree or challenge me, I need to interrupt my immediate instinct to push back and to say, no, you're misunderstanding me. You're wrong. This is actually how it is. Instead, I need to train myself and say, hey, thanks so much for sharing that with me. It seems like you have a different perspective. Can you share a little more about how something I said wasn't quite inclusive or how I'm misunderstanding something? I want to learn. I'm very aware that I don't know everything, of course. And I want to find out more. I want to learn more about your perspective. This actually happened fairly recently on LinkedIn. I was making a post and I used a specific terminology for Asian American, Native Hawaiian, Pacific Islander month, which was May. Mm-hmm. So we just passed that. And someone pointed out that I wasn't using the right terminology. And my first response was, hey, you know, I'm using the terminology that I'm using for these reasons. I cited some research. I said, but terminology changes. I'm open to learning new ways to use that language. I was expecting that they would just back off and say, okay, you figured it out. But instead they said, Lily, I actually think you're misunderstanding something. Here's some new sources. Here's some new information. Consider that. And I said, okay, I'll think about it. So I did some more reading. I did some more learning. I spent like 2 hours looking through new sources. And I said, you know what? I was wrong. I think I was wrong. Like I came to my own perspective after many hours of research, but I actually think I got it wrong the first time. So I updated all the language that I used. I messaged this person. I said, hey, I'm really sorry for messing up the first time. I did look into it. I think you're right. I think I missed something. Thanks for teaching me. And then I moved on, right? I didn't want to make a big deal of it. And maybe I shouldn't even be talking about it on this podcast. But no, I think
it's amazing. I think it's a strength, an amazing experience. And it shows how humble you are and mindful and present. You weren't attached to your belief system and your terminology. You were open-minded. And I think it's a strength, actually, because you know what you're worth, you know what you value, and you were open to explore. And when you explore, you say, okay, yes, I need to change. You were really agile. I think it's an amazing, amazing example of a mindful leader, because you're not coming out of ego. You're really coming to serve and to bring your knowledge and wisdom. And when someone said something, you create the space. What you actually help companies to do, you do by yourself. And this is, I believe, why you have so much followers, because they feel it and they feel respected. And they feel that they have their place and they feel seen, and you take into account what they're saying. So this is amazing. And I think you should say it, because I think, you know, it is, I'm circling back to the beginning, because you actually walk the talk from the first story that you brought, that you weren't aligned with your value and it didn't work. But this was your amazing lesson at the beginning of your career. And actually, this is what you implement in your career path. And this is what makes you, I think, successful, because you really walk the talk and you really care deeply about what you're doing and about other people, viewpoints, and being present. So I think it's an amazing story. Thank you for sharing.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I do feel like right now, agile is the term that you used, right? And I think a lot of leaders are scared of engaging in those kinds of conversations. And they want to create a persona for themselves as someone who's always right, as someone who knows all the answers, as someone who's firm and confident and strong. And that might have worked in the 1980s, that might have worked in even the 2000s, but it's 2023, right? And the world is changing and shifting every day. I don't think it's possible to know what's going on all the time, right? Like sometimes I check the news and I'm like, oh my gosh, a new thing happened, right? How are we supposed to keep up with this? I think the only way forward for leaders is to be humble and to recognize that no one knows the answers, including leaders. And people aren't even expecting leaders to have all the answers. They're expecting leaders to be vulnerable and to be more human and to make mistakes. But a lot of leaders don't know how to do that. They're scared of doing that. And to be fair, I'm still scared every single time I write on social media, I don't know, or I got it wrong, or I'm not sure. Because I feel that same pressure to have all of the answers. I want to be polished. I want to always know, but sometimes I don't. And saying that is increasingly expected among, you know, my followers on LinkedIn. And I think, you know, among employees at most corporations, they don't expect their leaders to know everything. They expect their leaders to be human.
That's right. And actually, when you are writing that you don't know the answers, what are the feedback of your followers?
Well, sometimes if I ask for them, you know, to share information, some of them share information, which is great. And sometimes I also have followers who say, oh, thank goodness, I thought I was the only one who didn't know.
You see?
Right? Think about being a student many, many years ago, right? What's the saying? Like, if you have a question, there's probably another student who has the same question.
Sure.
That applies to CEOs. That applies to everyone, right? If you have a question, it's likely... It's not because you're the dumbest person in the room. It's because you have hit on something that a lot of other people are probably curious about, but everyone's too scared to say.
And you are the brave man, the leader who talks. See, we're circling back. We're finished.
I suppose bravery plays a small role in it. So again, it doesn't feel like bravery to me. It feels like the right thing to do. Right. It feels like, look, this is a big problem. For example, one of the things that I say I don't know around is what is the future of the diversity, equity, and inclusion industry? Mm-hmm. Here in the US, it's under attack right now. Like there's a lot of controversy and critique about DEI. And I want to be able to say, I really do. I want to say, I have a crystal ball. I can see the future. I know what it's going to look like, but I don't. I'm scared. Sometimes I wonder if I'll wake up tomorrow and the industry will be gone. Or sometimes I wonder if, you know, there's going to be a big attack on this work and no one's going to want to do DEI work anymore. Like it makes me anxious sometimes. And I think this is an anxiety that every practitioner has, right? And every practitioner wants to know that there is a clear, certain future, but I don't think there is, right? And that's one of the things we need to talk about, because if we can acknowledge the uncertainty, we can start moving forward and taking action and doing something about it instead of just being too scared.
Yes. And, you know, I think, again, it comes to living mindfully and being present with what's happening right now. We don't know what will be the future, right? We're living in uncertain times. It changes. There's the VUCA reality, and we need to be able to handle ourselves in this reality and to live in this uncertainty, and it will unfold so we can have all the answers. And this is part of being a mindful leader and being brave or present with what we know right now. What will be in the future? It's not us to know. Lee, it was such an inspiring and exciting conversation. You really, really inspired me. I love the way it started from the beginning. Ended the end of our conversation, because it really shows what does it mean to walk the talk, to really believe in values and bring them and have such a big impact on the world. So thank you for joining. It's really a big pleasure. And I believe people who want to follow you and have your services, can you tell them where can they find you?
Sure. So you can find more about myself and my work primarily on my LinkedIn. So you can find me at Lily Zhang on LinkedIn, and also through my website, Lily Zhang, LILYZHENG.CO. You can learn more about my work there and reach out if you'd like to work together.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hope you enjoyed the conversation. You're invited to subscribe to our podcast in order to know when we upload a new episode and follow us on social media. Thank you for listening. Until next time, take care and bye-bye.